KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence features over 30 community-built projects happening all over Portland, including the Mudbone Community Farm, Sherritt Square, and Portland University. Additionally, there are also ticketed evening events featuring speakers and local musicians. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And welcome to the KBO Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM the first Wednesday of each month, streaming live on kbo.com and also archived. Our engineer today is Tammy Dean. Good morning, Tammy. My name is Alon Rab, and I'm joined in the studio by April Streeter. Good morning, April. How are you today?
Good morning, Alon. I'm great, thank you.
In the first half of the show, we will talk with Dervla Murphy, cyclist, activist, writer, and environmentalist, who will speak to us from her home in County Waterford, Ireland. In the second half of the hour, we will be joined by ornithologist Donald Krudzma, whose latest book is Listening to a Continent Sing, Birdsong by Bicycle from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and who will talk with us from Lava Tubes National Monument in Northeastern California. Before we introduce Dervla Murphy and hear of her cycling adventures across the world, a few news items from across the vast cycling universe. First, though, a reminder to our Portland, Oregon listeners that the yearly Pedalpalooza celebration is taking place throughout the month. The good folks at Shift to Bikes have put together, as always, a fantastic list of rides and activities. For more information, check shifttobikes.org or the printed schedules available around town. And while still in the city by the Willamette River, 21st Avenue Bicycles of Northwest Portland closed its doors after 11 years. It operated in the same spot where Northwest Bicycles existed from 1975 to 2007. 43 years of continual bicycle service have thus ended. As a reader of the BikePortland.org site commented, these kinds of shops are the fabric of our city and are slowly being replaced with overpriced knick-knack novelty shops and overpriced housing. It is sad and troubling for the future of our city. Longtime store mechanic Kevin Purcell and his partner Becky Newman are opening their own bike shop, Golden Pliers, at 1451 North Skidmore Street. Good luck to both of you, and a thank you to you, Kevin, and to all the skillful mechanics of Northwest 21st Avenue who helped keep my bike rolling over the years. From Takoradi, Ghana, comes a new story about graphic design student Frank Darko, who built a bicycle capable of moving on water. The creation joins earlier water bikes from the late 19th century and operates beautifully on lakes and slow-flowing rivers. The young inventor said that his creation was promoted by his love for science and technology, and after seeing the effects of flooding in his hometown, and especially how children could not get to school. The floating bike consists of the basic structure of a bicycle, a rotating motor, and wheels that are floating wood. Commercial production is being discussed. And finally, the first ever Saudi Arabian women's bike race took place on April 7th. 47 women rode a 10-kilometer race in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. Cycling for women was legalized just 5 years ago in the kingdom, though with a stipulation that women could only ride for recreation in parks if dressed modestly and with a male guardian present. The event, part of World Health Day, was organized by Be Active, a women's cycling advocacy and training group. The public response was largely positive, though fundamentalist critics predictably attacked it. Organizer Nadima Abu El Hanan, head of the Jeddah Women Cyclist Organization, declared that the race is a new dawn and a new day for Saudi women and women in other parts of the world. Nadima and her comrades are planning on organizing more races in the near future. Since the earliest days of cycling, long journeys have cast their spell on men and women. Our first guest, Dervla Murphy, has been riding for nearly 8 decades and sharing her humorous, insightful, and wise observations in her over 20 books, starting with her 1965 book, Full Tilt, which chronicled her ride from Ireland to India. Ms. Murphy has cycled and written about travels on 4 continents, as well as an autobiographical account of her childhood and youth titled Wheels Within Wheels. As an author's note in one of her recent books describes, quote, now in her 80s and with a new hip, she continues to travel and remains passionate about politics, conservation, bicycling, and beer. We are happy and honored to have Dervla Murphy as our guest. Good morning, Ms. Murphy, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, and I'm very happy to be with you.
We appreciate.
I'm very pleased to hear about the Saudi women and their bicycle race. That's really good news.
I had a feeling you would like that, and it is a great, great news item. And another good news item: Ireland just went through gigantic changes, voting decisively to repeal one of the world's more restrictive abortion bans. So, congratulations on that vote.
Thank you very much. We had great rejoicing last week about that.
It took a while, but...
So there are things improving in the world.
Amen, amen.
Yeah, amen.
Well,
all the disimprovement.
We'll start, with your permission, with the beginning. Excuse me if you've been asked this a million times, but how did you become a cyclist? What are some of your earlier memories connecting with this vehicle?
Well, I suppose when I was a child in the 1930s, born in 1931, and, everybody in Ireland cycled, more or less. You know, old women who lived out in farmhouses several miles from the town would cycle in, usually on a Friday, once a week, collect their pensions or whatever they could get from the post office. I go to the shops and load up their bicycles and their In those days, people didn't wear knapsacks or rucksacks, but they wore, which I quickly learned not to do, full bags slung over their shoulders, which is, as we all know, extremely dangerous for a cyclist.
Yes.
But that's what they did.
Wow.
So there was nothing unusual about cycling distances then. You know, if you wanted to go somewhere, you cycle there. It was quite simple.
And how old were you when you got your first bicycle?
I was 10, for my 10th birthday.
So, but it
but
was a big deal.
Of course, I cycled. Very big deal.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And how did...
Yes?
How did you move from riding, you know, to get milk or pick up groceries to cycling across Europe and the world?
Well, I just enjoyed cycling so much as a method of transport and exercise that when I decided, I had already decided before I got the bicycle on my 10th birthday, I had already decided that I wanted to go to travel to India eventually when I was grown up. And then when I had my own bicycle, I decided that I would cycle to India because that was the obvious way to get there when you enjoyed cycling.
Well, it was. It might have been
unfortunately.
Well, I think it might have been obvious for you, but I'm so fascinated by the fact that as a woman, you didn't feel that there was a barrier there to you getting on the bicycle and taking off on a trip of that magnitude.
No, I didn't feel there was any barrier.
Wow.
And there wasn't. I mean, I was right. There wasn't any barrier.
Well, I want to read you this quote that came from the first book, Full Tilt. I thank God for my sanguine temperament, which refuses to allow me to believe in disaster until it is finally manifest. And you've said that I never cross my bridges until I come to them. I think that's fascinating to me because I'm on the opposite side of being somebody who worries too much about what might be coming and trying to plan ahead. But it sounds like, at least in those beginning journeys, you didn't worry too much about planning ahead.
No, no, I did. I never, on no journeys did I plan ahead in any sort of detail. I always feel that, you know, what adds the real savor to a journey is unpredictability. You know, my best journeys were in regions and the times when, you know, I would travel for a few thousand miles and every morning waking up, set out, and never know where I would be that night, where I would be sleeping.
Wow, so getting lost didn't...
For me, that's the essence of traveling.
Okay.
And, you know, in your biography, you have written about your childhood and youth with your parents, helping your mother, taking care of her. Your dad, I believe, was also in prison for IRA activities. Do you feel like you got a lot of your independence and courage from your home? Or?
Oh, I do, very much so. And my mother was the first person to suggest that I should, when I was 16, that I should leave Ireland and cycle around the continent every year, you know, for a month or 6 weeks.
Wow.
As part of my education. And in those days, that was not the sort of thing that the average mother suggested.
No, it doesn't seem like it.
Very grateful to her for that.
And that was just after the war, so I assume, you know, Europe was still in ruins and people were...
Oh, indeed. I remember the dreadful state Cologne was in, and other towns, you know, as I cycled along the Rhine. But it was amazing, too, the rate at which reconstruction was taking place. You know, very, very efficient, hard, well-organized work, which is just what you would expect of Germans. And they've, you know, they were fulfilling all the stereotypes.
So
they
tell
getting on with the job.
Tell us a little bit about that first long journey in 1963 from Ireland to India. It didn't seem to cost you very much, £64. But what were some of the
That's right.
Yeah, what were some of the bigger challenges that you did overcome? And maybe you could talk a little bit about whether you had maps of everywhere you were going, or whether you just set off, as you say, and found out where you got to by the end of the day.
Oh, I had maps.
Okay.
But in those days, there was no, almost no tarred road between the Turkish border and the Pakistani border.
Wow.
So that was mostly gravel or, well, rough paths, really. Rough tracks, we would call them now.
Okay. So maybe you better tell us a little bit about your bicycle, that you could go on these kind of roads, and also why you named your bicycle Roz.
Oh, after Rosinante in Don Quixote, that story.
Okay, yeah.
And I've always enjoyed that story as a child. Huh. So I thought Roz would be a good luck sort of name.
Okay. And the bike, did it have gears?
I had all the gears taken off because I was told on those rough roads or tracks, lack of roads, that it would be much better to have no gears.
Wow.
So they were, it was a three-gear derailleur when I bought the bicycle originally. But then I was advised to take the gears off. And I had very good pannier bags, good strong saddle rack. And that was it.
Hmm.
And when you were traveling in areas where maybe, you know, towns were quite a ways apart, how did you manage with food? Did you have some sort of sleeping bag or
oh, always. I wouldn't cross the road without a sleeping bag.
And what about food?
That's essential bit of equipment. Yes.
Okay. So is there something you always had with you to stave off sort of those kind of hunger attacks that sometimes come when you're bicycling long distances?
Oh, I took the famous mint, you know, mint blocks.
Uh-huh.
That it's very, very, they take up very little space. They give you, I mean, they're not sustaining in the sense that they are, you know, mostly sort of sugary stuff.
Yeah, thin
but
mints.
They give you, they keep you going.
Okay, so you kept going with thin mints or after eights or something like that, something small but that gave you little bursts of energy.
Exactly.
Okay, so once you got to a place, did you then travel around? When you got to India, for example, did you travel around by bicycle inside the country so that you could discover different places?
No, I didn't, because it was too hot.
Ah.
I got to New Delhi in the middle of summer. And then I got talking. I said I wanted... I was pretty shocked the first time I arrived in Pakistan and India by the poverty. Which, of course, I was all the more shocked because I'd just spent time in Afghanistan where there was no poverty at that stage, before the Russian, Soviet, and American armies got going in Afghanistan. It was a really, really prosperous place. Undeveloped, but prosperous.
Wow.
And then over the Khyber Pass, suddenly down into the awful poverty of Pakistan and India. And which seemed, of course, more awful to me then because it was my first time encountering it. And it was, objectively, it was awful. But when I went back to India, unfortunately, in a way, one gets used to that sort of thing.
Mm.
You know, one has to become hardened to it.
Well, speaking of becoming hardened, did you have fear of assault in those first trips, especially by men when you were sleeping out someplace or even when you were on the road, or you just didn't anticipate any kind of trouble?
Well, I had two very unpleasant encounters with men, but I mean nothing unexpected, nothing terrifying. One was on the border, the Turkish Iranian border, and the other was shortly after that, funnily enough, in the same area. But I mean, nothing like that would ever happen to you in Afghanistan, because in those days, I'm sure it's quite different now. In those days, the Muslim code was so strictly adhered to. Actually, one night when I was it was very high. I was at about 10,000 feet, so it was quite chilly in May. And the only place to sleep was in a shepherd's hut. And, you know, there was absolutely no question of, apprehension about spending the night in a pretty remote hut with a single young man. I mean, the traditional Muslim code of honour towards women is very remarkable and very much to be respected.
You're listening to the KBO Bike Show on 90.7 FM and through live streaming at kbu.fm, and the show is also archived under bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. We're speaking with author and activist Dervla Murphy, whose wonderful books have been an inspiration to me and to many others. Her latest book centers on her travels and stay in Israel-Palestine, and as with all her work, are descriptions of a journey, but also of a land and a society. Dervla, I wanted to ask you about traveling solo versus traveling with a companion. You've traveled with your 9-year-old daughter in the Andes, and maybe with your grandkids. How do you compare the two, in traveling alone versus traveling with a companion? And what does traveling with children?
Always I prefer traveling alone.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
I mean, I traveled with my daughter when she was 5 and 6, and that was fine, you know, just traveling with a child, your own child. But otherwise, and then I went just for the first month of my Cuban journey, my daughter and 3 granddaughters were with me. But otherwise, all my journeys have been completely alone, and I wouldn't want any other companion with me than Rachel, my daughter.
Darn, so, I was just going to offer to join you on one of your next trips, but I guess it won't happen, so.
So we've been very interested, too, in your approach to traveling as you've gotten older, because some people don't really have the they don't have the courage anymore to go out traveling, but it seems like you've not only written about this in the introduction to the book To Oldly Go, Tales of Intrepid Travel by the Over 60s. And so can you talk to us just a little bit about being an older traveler?
Well, I think a great advantage, not actually in Europe, I wouldn't know about the United States, not in Europe, but elsewhere, I think the tremendous advantage is being an elder. You are respected in traditional communities, and everybody's extra kind to you and extra helpful and so on. Of course, obviously, you can't do as much physically as you did, but there are no other reasons for not traveling far and wide, except, of course, when you get to my present stage. Because now a full stop has been put to my traveling. There'll be no more travels.
Oh, it's over.
Because I've got emphysema.
Uh-huh.
And therefore,
I'm sorry to hear that.
Can't breathe properly. But you can't complain at 86 about something like that, you know. I mean, bodies are machines, machines wear out, and that's that.
Or you could complain and no one listens. So. But
well, you could try that.
Yeah. our time is just disappearing so fast, unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, changes you noticed in traveling 50 years ago and today. When I travel, I often notice that cyclists and other travelers spend more time rushing to the computer or posting photos of themselves.
God.
Has that been your experience also? How has travel changed?
Yes, recently I've been horrified to see them settling down. The first thing they want to do in the evening is to get on their computer and get in touch with the boyfriend or the parents or home. Well, I mean, why don't they stay at home? And these people, if they go traveling, they should be concentrating on where they are.
Yeah, being present.
But I'm afraid those days are over. I don't think real travel in the old fashioned sense will actually ever happen again, because everybody is so addicted to these gadgets.
And when you say the old-fashioned sense, do you mean in the sense of not knowing what might happen tomorrow, not knowing where your road will take
you?
Exactly. Okay. So a little bit more of that spirit, that adventurous era of travel in that sense might be over.
I'm afraid so.
That's kind of sad.
Well,
because you see, it's very difficult to get away from motor roads. And I detest motor roads and what they do to a region, because when they come, they bring with them not only poisonous fumes, but they bring all the so-called goodies, temptations, let's say, of the consumer society. So you go to an area which previously, you know, everybody would have had perfectly sound teeth, and you discover that since the motor road arrived, it was possible to transport Coca-Cola in large quantities, so the children's teeth are rotting by the time they're 6 or 7.
Yeah.
And I think that is tragic.
That is tragic.
It is.
Really tragic.
Dervla, I don't know where the time has gone, but we have about 3 more minutes, so I'd like to ask you the last question. You have described global capitalism's destructive march, and in your words, its sustained and dreadfully successful campaign to make most people dissatisfied with what I would call the normal life and some would call the simple life. Still, throughout your writings and life, there seemed to be such a strong vein of hope. Can you elaborate in the next 2.5 minutes where you find hope?
Right. I find hope in the fact that the present form of what I call rampant capitalism, I'm not against what you might call primitive capitalism, because the whole of human development has actually been built on that. But at present, over the last half century or so, a very diseased form of capitalism has taken over the world. And I think it is so diseased that it is actually rotting away at its own center. And I don't think it'll be around for that much longer. And I fear that its collapse, which I regard as inevitable, will be unpleasant. But I think probably we human beings will learn a lot from that collapse, and that we'll do better next time, next chance. And that's why I go on feeling hope. And also the fact that everywhere I have found ordinary human beings trustworthy. That doesn't mean that they're particularly nice or that one would warm to them personally, you know, as sort of friend, lifelong friend, but trustworthy. And that is, I think that is what's going to stand to us in the future. And it's what I've always taught my daughter and now my granddaughters. You must trust people. Don't think everybody is going to do you down or attack you. Just trust people.
And that is a wonderful way to end our interview. You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon at 90.7 FM and on the web at kbo.fm. Thank you, Derevla Murphy, for being with us today and for your good work in writing and action for environmental justice and sanity for freedom. Much success with your future.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Thank you, Derevla.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Goodbye and happy pedaling.
Thank you.
And if you ever make it to Portland, Oregon, there is a bed and a bike waiting for you.
So, marvelous. I remember that.
Thank you.
If you ever make it to Lismore, in County Waterford, Ireland, there are beds waiting here and bicycles.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye. In the second half of the show, we will talk with biologist Donald Kruzma, whose latest book is Listening to a Continent Sing, Birdsong by Bicycle from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on the web at kbo.fm. In the studio are April Streeter and Alon Robb. In the first half of the show, we spoke with Irish writer, activist, firebrand, and all-around inspirational person, Derevla Murphy, who at 86 is still embarking on adventures. In the second half of the show, we are happy to have as our guest Professor Donald E. Kruzma, one of the world's leading experts on bird songs, whose research and writings have focused on birds' vocal behavior, including neural control, evolution, and ecology. Since his 1972 dissertation titled Singing Behavior of the Beeweeks Wren, Development, Dialects, Population Structure, and Geographical Variation, and through such works as the Backyard Birdsong Guide Series, which covers North America, he has done much to further our understanding of birds. His latest book is Listening to a Continent Sing, Birdsong by Bicycle from the Atlantic to the Pacific, a record of a 10-week journey with his son David, a climate scientist who's also written a book about cycling, across 4,200 miles. Good day, Donald Kruzma, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Al Alone. A total pleasure.
With your permission, I'd like to start with some sounds of birds. I hope you don't object.
How could I possibly object? That's all I do in life, it seems, is listen to birds.
So, Alon, do you want to tell us which type of bird song we were listening to?
Oh, I think I could tell you.
Okay.
Alon, are you going to tell us?
No, I think that was a slip of tongue, or maybe, you know, I will let you describe the bird.
Oh, it's a hermit thrush. And, you know, I recorded hermit thrushes a few places across the country on this bike trip, but I especially remember one just out of Sisters. We're climbing up to McKenzie Pass, and there was this hermit singing. We rounded the bend. He stayed with us a long time. And a hermit thrush, you know, we could talk about hermit thrushes for a couple of hours, but I don't think we have that time. Let me just say that the hermit thrush has about a dozen different songs, and he chooses the next song that he sings so that it is especially different from the one he just sang. So it's really a remarkable exercise in contrast. He knows what he's doing.
And where did the name hermit come from? I assume that they meet another thrush if they want to keep the species going, so they're not totally hermits.
Well, sometimes they're called swamp angels. I think sometimes you hear them singing all by themselves. You know, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that word, hermit.
Well, maybe we should step back for a second. And so just as you were describing, you know, your sisters, you're going up McKinley, and I'm wondering, what were you carrying in order to catch these bird songs? I think that will help our listeners kind of come into your world of being on a bicycle and also chasing bird songs.
Well, mostly at this point, I was carrying my ears. And a very inexpensive tape recorder. And I will confess that I came back with good high-quality recording gear to capture the songs that I heard all along this journey, because the narrative just had to be supplemented with the best possible voices from these birds that I could capture. So I actually started out the trip with good with a parabolic reflector. I had it shaped so it formed a windshield on my bicycle. It was a very, very sexy setup. But in the end, I'm using a big parabolic reflector, like a satellite dish that brings the sounds in and concentrates the sounds at the microphone. It's wonderful listening through headphones when you're out there recording.
So were you carrying this equipment on your bicycle? Was there a caravan of fancy SUVs, you know, with fancy recording equipment trailing you? How did it work exactly?
Well, for most of the journey, I had what's called a shotgun microphone. It's a highly directional microphone that you can hold up to a bird. And when this trip was done, I was using a little mini disc recorder. And this little mini disc was capable of capturing the fine tunes of these birds. So I would be out every morning in our campground a good hour before sunrise, listening, recording, capturing what I heard. And it was very sad to see the Pacific come, because it meant the end of the journey.
Hmm. And the journey started where exactly?
Started in Virginia. I was a professor at University of Massachusetts. I want to say Oregon State, but that's where I got my doctorate many years ago, studying Buick's Rins. I've been working too many years, and so my son and I said, well, let's bike across the country. And like Dervla said, it renews your faith in people, and it certainly did that. And sometimes when you're on a long trip like this, you see the world a little differently from the rut you have been in, and it transforms And it's a transition to a totally new life, which it was for me somewhere around Wyoming. I realized that I wasn't going back to work.
Wow. So that's a big revelation.
Yeah. Well, yes. I celebrated my 57th birthday in Dayville, Oregon. We had two cupcakes with 57 candles in them. We lit them, and it was a huge fire. And I realized about then that I was not going back to my full-time secure for life position as a tenured professor. I was going to stop that, working in an academic environment, and try to communicate with real people, non-academics, about the amazing world of birdsong. So here I am talking to you.
That is awesome.
Your audience.
So that does bring me to a question, and that is, there's an entire genre of road trip by bicycle books, but yours is unique. And I'm wondering if along that road from the Atlantic to the Pacific that you ran into other birdsong bicyclists. Did you find, is there a little, you know, cadre of them hiding out in campgrounds everywhere?
You might think so, but we saw almost everything imaginable along the road except anyone interested in birdsong. Well,
wow.
Actually, everyone's interested in birdsong once you start talking about it. But we saw jugglers, musicians, Shriners Hospital supporters, people from all over the world, most of them bicycling from Oregon across to the east, hoping the prevailing winds would blow them across Kansas. But not us. We wanted to fight those winds all the way across the country.
This is a pretty big question, but why birds? Why not lizards? Why not cats? How did your fascination with birds, how was that born?
Oh, I could confess, I had to have a required project for a vertebrate biology class my second semester in college, second semester senior year, my last semester. And I ended up watching the migration of birds through a local marsh. And alone, birds sing. Your lizards don't sing. They're beautiful. I could ride my bicycle all the way across the continent and not hear a single lizard or see a single lizard. But every second of the way, I'm listening to birds. Birds just are out there. They're constantly present, constantly in our lives, if we just open our ears and listen.
Well, you've definitely converted me. I didn't think I would ever be fascinated by birdsong or by a bicycle birdsong trip, but as soon as I started reading about your travels, it really got me to thinking about how the birds are ever present, and it's only when they're gone that we will start to notice it, and so we have to do some kind of conservation. So I really appreciate what you're doing to try and turn on the entire world to birdsong. That's pretty awesome.
Yes, and as you say, we know they're absent, and the book Silent Spring, of course, emphasized that and brought about a revolution in how we appreciate the environment.
Well, I'd like to play another few seconds here from a song, this time by the black-caped chickadee. And incidentally, Donald Kruzma's website, listeningtoacontinentsing.com, has 350 plus recordings, and of course his book is available. So I'll play the chickadee. And the recordings are usually about 5 minutes or longer. We're just playing a few seconds here. What can you tell us about this particular recording in bird?
Oh, that's number 359, I think, in the book. Can you confirm that?
There'll be a test about what number, where does it go? And
I have to tell you that all the black cap chickadee is a remarkable bird. All the way across the country, all the way up to the Cascade Ranges, range of mountains, the birds all have the same song. And the mnemonic might be, hey, sweetie. It's a high whistle followed by a two-syllable low whistle. I don't know if I can whistle it. I'll try it. Something like that. There's something isolating about the Cascade Range of mountains. And as soon as we dropped down into the Willamette Valley and went to my beloved William Finley National Wildlife Refuge just south of Corvallis, we heard the Willamette Valley dialect. And it was, you know, this is the kind of thing that all the way across the country I was anticipating hearing this particular singing form of the black-capped chickadee in Oregon. So it's to me, that's a very special recording. It takes me back to 1970, roughly, when I first heard these birds in the Willamette Valley.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So tell us a little bit about the trip in general. Riding 4,200 miles in 10 weeks, that's quite an athletic feat. So I wonder, did you organize, and was it very specific that you had to hit certain places at certain times, or was it more free-flowing and you could just kind of pull off the road when you heard a bird that you hadn't heard before, or that did you check off on your list, something like that? If you could give us a little bit of a color about what that trip was like.
Oh, we use the Adventure Cycling Association maps. They have maps that'll take you on a number of wonderful bicycle routes all across the country. They tell you where the campgrounds are, where you can resupply with food, one of the most essential things. So, no, we knew when we started. We wanted to start on the Virginia coast in May because the birds are singing. It's beautiful that time of year. It's migration. If you start in Oregon, which is what most people do, you have to wait until late June till the snow melts off the mountain passes. That then puts you in Kentucky and Virginia in July and August, which is not such a nice time to be there. So we planned the trip perfectly to hear the maximum number of birds. We hurried along as much as we could so that when we got to Oregon, the birds would still be singing, because by the time you hit mid-July in Oregon, most of the birds are done singing for the year. So we had campgrounds all picked out. I had special places where I knew we just had to stop because there were special birds. A hybrid zone between the black-capped chickadee and the Carolina chickadee in Missouri. So I had planned it out pretty well. My son, he said, well, the best way to go on a bike trip is just get on your bike and go. But I had to have a plan. I had birds on my mind.
Yeah.
And speaking of athletic feats, I'm thinking of some of the ones in the world of birds, you know, hummingbirds who spend so much energy keeping themselves in the air, migrating. What are some of the amazing athletic feats, if you will, of birds that you've encountered?
Oh, yes. Hummingbirds, we were told by physiologists they could not possibly migrate across the Gulf of Mexico. Well, turns out, of course, they did. There are shorebirds that leave Alaska and fly nonstop over the Pacific Ocean for days on end, 6, 7, 8 days, I forget the exact number, nonstop until they hit New Zealand, as if they know exactly where they're going. Birds that spend their life seemingly flying all the time, albatrosses, oh, we could go on and on. birds, not only athletic feats, but they have sensory. They can sense things that we can't, like magnetic fields, and they can see into the ultraviolet. And so they see colors on each other that our eyes cannot detect. It's a whole new marvelous world, this world of birds.
So you've also written that bird songs and calls provide a window into their minds. And this is, of course, a whole huge question and a huge opening. But why do birds sing? Is it mostly like, hey, honey, come over here? Or is there a lot more communication that's conveyed that we can start learning as amateur bird song listeners?
Well, I think most of the singing here in temperate North America, tropics might be quite different, but in North America, I think it's mostly the males. Some species of females sing, but it's mostly the males that are singing to attract or impress females in some way. So all of this singing during the dawn chorus, we think it's mostly the males who are doing the singing to impress females, to try to convince the females that that particular male should father their offspring. So that's mostly what it's about. And you can think of the female. Some of my women friends have said, oh, how sad that the female doesn't sing. But you can think of the female because she makes the choice as to which singers are going to leave offspring for the next generation. You can think of the female as being the silent composer of everything that the male does. So she's really in charge. If he's singing the wrong songs, he will leave no offspring. So it's a partnership in what we hear. Sure, the male is singing it, but almost certainly it's the female who's designed what he is singing.
And how much individual variation is there? How much learning of new songs?
Oh, there's a special group of birds we call the true songbirds, and I had about 4,500 of them. They have special brains. They are designed to learn to imitate songs, and so each male has to hear other songbirds and imitate them to some extent in order to develop normal songs. But a lot of variation. One of my favorite birds is a brown thrasher. It's related to the mockingbird that you have here in Oregon. This brown thrasher I studied last year had 1,200 some different songs that he could sing. Mockingbird, maybe only 100 to 200, but still, you know, very impressive. And you can learn to recognize individuals by their songs, just like we recognize humans by our voices. They have a world that's equally socially complex, I think, to what many of us humans have.
So the females that are listening to these songs, what are they exactly listening for? Are they listening for those individual signatures that you're talking about, where they're thinking like, okay, that guy knows how to, yeah. What is it that they need to hear?
You would make an excellent scientist. We have no good answers to that question.
Uh-huh, okay.
Some would like to say, well, the more songs a male sings, the more a female will be impressed, but there's really no good scientific evidence for that. One study that I admire says, well, the more consistently a male can sing his song, the more mates he gets. Well, I can start to believe that. Because a young bird, when he's developing a song, sometimes even when he's a yearling and sitting on his territory and trying to attract a mate, you can hear little inconsistencies in his song that tell us that, well, he's still working on his song. He doesn't have it quite perfected. Maybe he's still trying to learn and imitate precisely the local dialect, but he doesn't have it quite right. And if I were a female, I'd listen to that and say, you know, I might be better off having my offspring fathered by that older adult over there who's got his songs down perfectly.
Yeah, keep practicing, honey. It's probably what the female bird sang.
Something like that, yeah.
What are some of the contemporary dangers, threats to birds? I'm thinking of, you know, you have recordings done at Malheur Reserve, a place very rich in bird life that a couple of years ago was taken over by right-wing militias. There's also suggestions of opening it up for grazing. So what are some of the main threats to birds, and also how can our listeners help stop these threats?
Oh, my. Big question. Mm-hmm. You know, climate change is probably one of the most severe. Climate's changing so rapidly, more rapidly than it probably ever has. You know, will the birds be able to adjust? Those birds that nest on top of the mountain, you know, as it gets warmer and that habitat is squeezed off the top of the mountain, where do the birds go? So I think one of the best things we can do is be very aware of climate issues and doing whatever we can to, I can throw in a political message here, but I'm reluctant to do so.
Oh, please, please do. No. <You're>, I mean, obviously.
I know I'd have friendly ears in Oregon, I know. Massachusetts has been described as the most liberal state in the country. Of course, that's where I live. So I think just being alert to climate change and, you know, habitat loss is another key issue. As we lose habitat, of course, we lose birds. Those are the two number one issues. We could talk about outdoor cats doing an enormous amount of damage, but I'd go with climate change and habitat loss. Hmm.
So as far as habitat loss is concerned, then do you, for example, create habitats for birds of your particular region in your own backyard? And is that something that you would recommend that other people do as they learn what particular species are native and are in their areas?
Yeah, when we think about habitat, we think of large-scale changes in the habitat and loss of massive areas. There are, of course, plants that you can place in your backyard that will attract certain kinds of birds, hummingbirds, making it a bird-friendly place. But the habitat loss, so at the Finley Refuge, for example, I was just talking to the biologist, Brian Root, there, and they're trying to bring back some of the savanna that was very typical of the Willamette Valley. And how much of this typical savanna is still left throughout the valley? I think he was saying something like 1 or 2% of the, the original habitat remains. So when you lose that kind of habitat, you've lost all the birds that live in that habitat. And Vesper sparrows, for example, in the Willamette Valley have been one. They used to be everywhere, and now they're just in a few isolated patches.
Hmm. Well, you told us a little bit about the map that you used for your trip and the Adventure Cycling Association. Do you have a corresponding conservation organization for birds that that would be a good idea for interested listeners to go and check out on the web?
Oh, there's always the American Bird Conservancy.
Okay.
They're good. Of course, the Audubon Society, I think they have returned to a strong bird message. Right off the top of my head, those two come to mind.
Do you have, among all the birds you've studied, encountered, recorded, are there any particular species that you feel more keen to? My late mother loved owls and hoopy birds, which are in the Middle East where I grew up. I like ravens. Is there any particular bird, or is that establishing an unnecessary hierarchy of likes here?
Oh, you know, we all have likes. I love wrens and thrushes, and there's a recording. I don't know how much time we have left, but 304, that very thrush. It's a
304.
And it illustrates.
Okay, I'll go to
illustrates something very remarkable about how birds sing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll go to that.
Well, maybe you should tell us or give us a hint of what the remarkable thing is we can be listening for.
The hint is this: we humans have one voice box that sits at the top of our windpipe. Birds have two voice boxes, and they sit at the bottom of the windpipe, where the windpipe branches off to the two lungs. Birds can sing with two voices simultaneously, and they're absolute masters at it. This very thrush, if you whistle and hum at the same time, you have two voices, and it's more or less what this varied thrush sounds like. He's doing things with his two voice boxes, so I think that they beat against each other.
Okay.
And we are set to listen to this amazing singer, and you recorded that at Lolo Pass in Powell, Idaho. And this would be a good time to end, also because our time is over. I would like to thank Donald Kruzma, biologist, conservationist, for being on the show. His new book, Listening to a Continent Sing, is worth buying, listening to, and it also has an internet connection and a link. So thank you very much, Donald Kruzma, and all the best. And so we'll say goodbye to you and then play the song. of the Bird, and you're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon. I'd like to thank my co-host, April Streeter. I'd like to thank our engineer, Tammy Dean, for her wonderful work, as always. And our two guests today, Derevla Murphy and Donald Kreutzma.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Donald. It was really a pleasure.
Oh, yes, thank you so
total
much.
Total pleasure, and happy listening to my Oregon friends.
And the invitation to visit when you're in Oregon is always there. So thank you very much, and all the best. We'll end the show with the song of the Varied Thrush.
Join KABU and Kofallen Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral